For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we've got the second of our special episodes focusing on the novels shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. Richard Powers reveals how a 60s sci-fi classic inspired him to create his latest novel, Bewilderment. Patricia Lockwood reveals her close links to sight loss as we discuss her razor-sharp novel, No One Is Talking About This. And we take a passage north through war-ravaged Sri Lanka with author Anouk Arad Prakasam. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Established in 1969, the Booker Prize is the world's most prestigious literary award for novels written in English and published in the UK and Ireland. Previous winners have included some of the greatest novelists of the past half century, and this year's shortlist was announced at the end of September. And, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation, RNIB library customers can shadow the judges as they ponder who this year's winner should be. That announcement will be made on the 3rd of November. But before then, Read On is on hand to bring you interviews with all the shortlisted authors. First up, Richard Powers was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2018 for Overstory, which went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. His follow-up, Bewilderment, has now also been shortlisted for the Booker, and likewise focuses on the ecological damage humans are doing to our planet, this time through the lens of a recently widowed space scientist and his otherworldly 9-year-old son. On a recent trip to London, Richard joined me down the line to tell me more. Richard Powers, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bewilderment begins in the wilderness with Theo, an astrobiologist who has taken his son Robin out of school after the boy has been suspended. And he's trying to calm Robin down. Robin is neuroatypical.
That's right. He's a 9-year-old boy who has just gotten in trouble for physically attacking one of his schoolmates. He is an intense child and one who is quite susceptible to bursts of anger. His father is struggling to raise him by himself after the death of the boy's mother a couple of years before the start of the novel.
Robin is potentially on the autistic spectrum, but Theo is fighting very hard against having his son put onto medication.
He has also received multiple diagnoses and not always a consistent read on his boy. And he has personal reasons to believe that much of what is happening to Robin is the result of this tragedy of losing his mother when he was 7. And while he is himself a scientist and does not approach his boy in a magical thinking way, he's reluctant to use a diagnostic category, especially one that hasn't settled firmly into a consensus, to replace the particulars of Robin's situation. I think he also legitimately feels that this rush to medicate children is a little problematic, especially for children that young. I think all of these things combine into a very difficult choice on his part. And Theo's choice to try to push back against medication certainly has consequences over the course of the book. But it is his desire to do right by his son and to protect his son from the world that sets the story in motion.
And part of his therapy for Robin is to take him to the wilderness of the Smoky Mountains National Park and immerse him in the natural world, take him away from the confusion of the society that they live in. And that society we see as they head back into the university town where Theo works is undergoing ecological disaster and social upheaval.
That's right. Robin like a lot of children, connects more readily and more fully to the more than human world than he does sometimes to his classmates and to adults. I don't think this is atypical. I think that this fascination with the living world is quite a pervasive characteristic, certainly of childhood. Children see amazement and sanctity in other things quite commonly. And there is another way in which Robin, I think, is characteristic of lots of children, wherever they fall on any distribution curve, in that he is also intensely feeling ecotrauma. As he begins to understand the reality of the moment of species extinction that adults have not only permitted, but have also caused, he responds with anger and fear. It is this quality of both love for the world beyond the human and rage at what the humans are doing to this world that makes the task of raising this child so very difficult for Theo. There is a moment in the book where Theo says, "We're doing just fine here in the woods, but going back to the city, it's all going to come apart again."
Yes, it terrifies him when he sees evidence of how unthinkingly mankind is destroying the environment around him.
Yeah. And as I say, I think that this is a pretty pervasive condition now in young children. Study after study and poll after poll have produced alarming numbers about how many children feel a sense of despair and pointlessness and anger about the world that they're inheriting.
Through the prism of Robin, we also feel that we should be angry, particularly as he tries to mount a one-child stand against the ecological disaster that is unfolding around him.
Yes, there is a slow and a subtle inversion of the dramatic crisis that launches the book. The book begins with this question: what is Robin's trouble? What is his difficulty and how best to treat it? And gradually, as the pages turn, that becomes replaced with this question: what is the problem with the adult world and how to best understand that and how best to treat that? So this question of Robin as being somehow problematic in his difference, of pathologizing his condition, of wanting to treat it, gradually gets replaced with the validity of Robin's challenge to the world of adult logic. And with that kind of moral absolutism, that kind of black and white sense of right and wrong that children, especially intense children, have, Robin does decide to become himself activist. He's a child who can spend hours drawing things. And he hits upon this project whereby he will illustrate endangered species, and he will bring them to the local farmers market, and he will sell them, and he will raise money for the cause. And that all works for a while until he begins to understand how little ability he has to change the things that are terrifying him.
Yes, and it's set in the United States in the near future, and there are echoes of a recent president who might have won a second term, steamrolling any kind of opposition to him. That just reinforces the hopelessness of Robin's stand against this executive power that can imprison you for referring to the president as a dung beetle.
Yeah, I would make only one small modification to what you said. The book does resemble those speculative fictions that use the near-term future as a way of making us see the present differently. This book is more like a near-present book. As the reader begins the story, she probably says, "I know exactly where we are. We're in 2019 America. And I can recognize all these events and all these characters that are impinging upon this father and the son from the outside." But little by little, the world of the book begins to diverge from the earth. It's almost like a parallel earth. And these threats that are familiar become strange again. And the reader is thrown back into the uncertainty and the sense of not knowing where these things are going to land is very much a character of this novel. And it was definitely a characteristic of my creation of the novel. What I wanted to do was to preserve and renew that sense of fear and uncertainty that the last 2 years of the Trump administration produced in the United States. As I was writing this book, I was writing it under lockdown in the advent of the 2020 election, but with all signs already showing that the administration was going to do everything in its power to fight a war on truth and to undermine the legitimacy of the election, even in the months running up to it. And as I was working on the book, I wasn't sure which was going to end first, my story or democracy in America. And that's the kind of uncertainty that I wanted to produce in the reader by creating this alternate Earth.
Creating alternate Earths is also the job of Theo, Robin's father. He is an astrobiologist. He uses spectroscopy to model the atmospheres of other planets that may or may not be habitable. And he also takes Robin to the imaginary surfaces of those planets as an alternative wilderness for Robin.
Yes, it happens that one of the very few things that can calm Robin down and re-engage him in a hopeful and a productive way are these adventures that he and his father make together, almost in place of bedtime stories. The planets that Theo uses to entertain his son are themselves based on actual exoplanets, the rash of new worlds that we've been discovering at such a clip in recent years. But the speculation about what kind of things life might be able to do in these very different places is a shared imaginative endeavor between father and son. And they open up this larger question of what life on Earth here is trying to do. What are its potentials? How hard is it to arise? What conditions are needed in order for it to flourish? How extreme an environment can it survive? And all of these things fire Robin's imagination. I mean, we're talking about two lost boys, in a way, who love each other, but are looking for ways to understand each other. And this shared imaginative journey across the universe is one place where they can talk about their hopes and their fears and their dreams indirectly. They can be together. They can talk about what's most urgent to them, but it can take the form of an adventure, of a voyage out there.
Yes, and empathy is very much at the core of this book. And as Robin's behavior at school deteriorates, Theo takes the hard decision to enroll him in an experiment with an empathy machine that ultimately leads him back to the boy's deceased mother.
Yes. I based this experimental procedure on a real-world technology that's now a little more than 10 years old called decoded neurofeedback. And it's a strange and quite remarkable process whereby the brain of one person who's engaged in a task or learning something or participating in an emotional state is scanned in real time and recorded as a data structure. Then the brain of a second person is also monitored by fMRI in real time, and that person is given cues about whether their neural activity is similar to or getting closer to or farther away from the neural activity of the original template. And once again, you know, I had spoken earlier about how this book exists in a kind of uncertain parallel earth where you're not sure what's real and what's being invented. This technology also, I think my deployment of it anyway, exists in a kind of ambiguous state where you're not sure what you're reading about actually exists, whether it might exist a year from now or 10 years from now or never. And so the book slides very gradually from realist psychological fiction into something more speculative. And Robin turns out to be a kind of virtuoso of this empathy technique, perhaps because of his difference, perhaps just because of his enthusiasm for the video game world. He becomes very, very skillful at making his own neural activity resemble the template. And when it becomes known that his mother actually participated as a subject and her own neural patterns were recorded prior to her death, here is this chance of opening up a portal directly between this boy and this woman who is now just a ghost to him.
In that plot device, there's a definite nod towards the novel Flowers for Algernon. And actually, Robin and Theo listen to the audiobook on their way back from the Smoky Mountains. And the title as well is taken from a quote at the beginning of Flowers for Algernon.
That's right. And I have to say, it was rather astonishing and wonderful for me. As I began writing this book, I realized as Robin was doing this training that this was kind of an exercise in the rapid development of emotional intelligence. A boy who is not in control of his feelings gradually becomes more capable of connecting to other people and in governing himself. And as I was writing this, I thought, boy, this sounds very familiar to me. And of course, as I was creating Robin, the 9-year-old, I was remembering my own self and my own differences and strangeness as a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old. And I belatedly rediscovered the obvious, which is when I was just a little bit older than Robin, I had read Daniel Key's classic story, Flowers for Algernon, which is the tale of an experimental intervention that gives a subject greater cognitive intelligence. And I thought, wow, there is a kinship between that plot and my own. I went back to Keyes's book and I was really moved to look at it again and to compare it to the story that I had remembered as a child. And you mentioned the epigraph, which is from Plato's Republic. And the passage in question is, the mind, like the eye, knows two kinds of bewilderment, one going into the light and one coming out of it. And there was my story in a nutshell. Robin is going into the light and he's bewildered by it. And of course, he's going to have to come out of the light, and that's going to be bewildering as well.
As with the copy of Flowers for Algernon that Theo and Robin listened to, bewilderment has been made into a terrific audiobook narrated by Eduardo Ballerini. Did you have anything to do with his selection as a narrator? And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I am a fan of audiobooks. I've become a real devotee in recent years. They mesh very wonderfully with my new passion for walking. There is something about being out in the world and moving while hearing a story unfold in inner space, you know, to be immersed in the outer space of the more than human in the living world, while at the same time hearing this human inner space narrative unfold. That's extremely powerful for me and extremely inspiring. I am a big Ballerini fan. I particularly liked his narration of the Knausgård novels, and I was given a choice of several very good narrators for Theo, and I just thought, with Eduardo, here is a person who knows how closely linked intelligence and emotions are. He can inhabit the innermost psychology of a character, but he does so with great intelligence and great nuance, and I'm delighted to hear that it played well for you.
We'd set up the scope on the deck on a clear autumn night, on the edge of one of the last patches of darkness in the eastern U.S. Darkness this good was hard to come by, and so much darkness in one place lit up the sky. We pointed the tube through a gap in the trees above our rented cabin. Robin pulled his eye from the eyepiece. My sad, singular, newly turning 9-year-old, in trouble with this world. Exactly right, I said. We might never find them. I always tried to tell him the truth, if I knew it, and it wasn't lethal. He knew when I lied, anyway.
Eduardo Ballerini narrating Bewilderment, written by my guest, Richard Powers. Well, Richard, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Bewilderment and for being a guest on the show today.
Oh, it was a great pleasure to be back, and hope we can talk again in the future.
Like all the books on this and previous year's Booker shortlists, Bewilderment is available from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generosity of the Booker Foundation. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this Booker Prize special episode, Anouk Arad-Prakasam explores the legacies of love and war in A Passage North. But first, Patricia Lockwood has been called the Poet Laureate of Twitter, and much of her well-documented life experience has found its way into her debut novel, No One Is Talking About This. She joined me from her home in Savannah, Georgia, to tell me more. Patricia Lockwood, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me, Red.
And many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
Thank you. Yes, people keep asking me how I'm feeling about that, and I don't think that I'm saying anything normal in response. It feels quite strange. Actually, you feel like you're walking around with the mark of the beast on your forehead. It changes you for all time, I think.
Well, by your own admission, you spent a long time on the publisher's slush pile. So it must feel like a bit of a vindication for all those years of hoping to get published.
You would think so, but really the slush pile I started out in was the poetry slush pile, where it's almost you expect to stay for 10 years or so. It's like there are 4 billion people in the world trying to publish poetry at any given time, and there's only one slot in each issue of the magazine for a poem. So I expected that, but yeah, I think since I had these previous books, it was quite easy for me to get the novel published. And then it really felt like I had just ridden all the way up the fairy tale slope immediately afterwards, because you publish your first novel and you don't really expect any sort of accolades to come in the wake of it.
Being a poet lends itself to an economy of language, and that obviously is even more of a constraint, I suppose, if you see it that way, with Twitter, where you only had a certain number of characters that you could write. How do you think that's helped hone your style?
I really like constrained writing, actually. I do much better with it than I do with just all constraints loosened. I like to sort of be in a compressed area where I have to think my way out. And you're right, there is, in the novel, there's a sense of a punchline that I really honed with poetry, and then later with something like Twitter. I think I'd probably operate in terms of punchline. And I've said before in the past that poems really are constructed like jokes. There has to be this buildup and there has to be this release, and there's a symmetry to it that releases at the end.
And there's certainly a lot of humor in the book. It begins with your unnamed protagonist logging on first thing in the morning to the portal, which is how you refer to the internet. And there's a world weariness to the narrator's voice. I was rather reminded of a smoker sparking up their first cigarette in the morning.
That's good. Yeah, as anyone who's ever been on the internet knows, getting on first thing in the morning is the worst thing you can do. It takes over your brain. This communal hive becomes your brain. It replaces your individuality. And it is, you know, you watch those old movies where everyone is constantly smoking and you're like, God, the clothes smell, the rooms smell, they're smoking in hospitals. We may have something in the future where we look at everyone just being on their phones in all of these situations too, and being like, they're just damaging themselves, man. They're giving themselves brain damage.
And that sense of claustrophobia, you describe the portal as a world getting closer and closer, a spider web that's enmeshing not just your narrator, but all of us.
Yeah, as if you're cocooning yourself. There is comfort to it. And I think many of us who really love the internet and consider ourselves natives of the internet went to it because it was a place of physical and mental and emotional comfort where we could feel more enclosed, but also feel this eternal openness. I was that way, certainly when I first discovered it. And I really felt that way up until maybe the last couple of years, maybe the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, you signed on to Twitter back in 2011. Mm-hmm. So I suppose you are a disenchanted veteran then.
I was talking to someone the other day. I asked when he first got on Twitter, and he was like, oh, I was about 13 years old and I got on in 2009. And I felt like such a latecomer to the party. And then I was like, oh, God, what did it do to you? 13 years old.
And the book features a protagonist who's, well, not unlike yourself. She travels the world giving lectures on the portal and her experience of it. And she has risen to fame by creating a meme.
Yes, it's Can a Dog Be Twins? And this is sort of the joke of the book, that she isn't like me in the sense that she's not traveling around the world talking about being a writer. She's traveling around the world just talking about this single post she made once upon a time and what that means for technology, what its implications are for the universe, for the world, this post, Can a Dog Be Twins?
Which indicates just how fatuous the internet can and has perhaps become.
Maybe, but there's also a little bit of a childlike wisdom to it, because if you consider the proposition, you do start to wonder, like, can it? Can a dog be twins? Does a mother dog give birth to 8 twins that are all identical? There is an actual answer to this question. I think that Twitter likes that sort of formulation, things that are almost naive in their presentation, but that actually do make you think. So you can say that it's fatuous. You couldn't even really say that it's glib, because we're not exactly being eloquent there. Like, glibness is not necessarily prized. But there is something about these maybe axiomatic posts that really inspire a lot of thinking, that can go on and on and on, because there's something about them that really does inspire thought.
Yes, and we see that the portal, the internet, can show you all the good things about human existence, the empathy, the beauty, the evanescent things. But it also acts as a megaphone for people with far less altruistic views. And that is encapsulated in your character of the dictator, who is a loosely disguised American president figure, perhaps.
I like the generosity of loosely disguised. It's like, who could it be? Who could it be? And that's a joke as well, of course, to call him the dictator. There were a lot of writers on Twitter who would not refer to him by name, who would not give him power, quote unquote, in that way. So it was also a little bit of a takeoff on that, while at the same time, you didn't want the name overrunning your text, this thing that you were putting your lifeblood, your philosophy, your thought into. It would be like being another one of his buildings, you know, just branded with the Trump name. So it was both things simultaneously. It was a little bit of a joke about that liberal impulse. And it was also true that you didn't want him in there in that way.
And the dictator has bludgeoned people into submission in many ways. He creates so much noise on the portal that people cannot think straight anymore. There's a wonderful quote that your protagonist uses about her mind. It used to be the place where you sounded like yourself, and now it's the place where we sound like each other. It's as if she can't think straight anymore, and none of us can.
Yeah, but there was a sense in which we all went willingly to that, too. We had the freedom to talk about whatever we wanted at any time of day in that place. But it felt so important to raise awareness, to stand in opposition to him. That was the air. That was the atmosphere in the portal at that time. It's all anyone could talk about. But at the same time, I mean, we did go willingly. We did allow it to overtake our speech, our language.
And that created polarization?
I should say so. Is that what you observed? It's what I observed.
Absolutely. Which I suppose in its own way curtails the freedom of speech. You have to be either one thing or the other, or silent.
Yeah, and silence was not really a choice. There is something about my particular feed where I never really talked about political things. I always wanted to craft little jokes, little stories, little vignettes, little surrealities that took people out of the discourse of the day. You know, if I saw a weird dog or something, that's what I was talking about. It was never the newspaper. But I felt the compunction just as much as anyone in that time, that if you were not paying attention at every moment, that if you were not talking about what he was saying with his exact words in your mouth, that you weren't doing everything you could.
And that presumably made you feel as if you had to control your tone in the tweets that you were producing. And that's something that comes through very much in the way your narrator is controlling the tone of the first half of the book. It's a very, very tight, almost challenging way of writing. You either have to go with it or just step away from it.
Yeah, it's extraordinarily controlled and it's even confrontational. You are at all times sort of walking along that razor's edge of tone. It's a kind of taste you're exercising as well. There are things that you wouldn't say. There are things that are beneath you to talk about. And as a poet, I have had historically extraordinary control of my tone. So that was a place where I lived. That was something I could do. But it also did seem to be beyond us in a way, that fear that like, the razor blade was sharper than it had previously been, that you really could turn wrong in a way that you previously hadn't been able to do.
Now, as I said in the introduction, it's a novel of two halves. And in the second half, it really takes a left turn as social media's glittery absurdity is put into sharp contrast by a family tragedy. And that itself is based on events that happened within your own family.
Yes, that is correct. So I'm not the type of person, I'm not the type of novelist. I don't have the sort of imagination where I'm going to make up a whole bunch of medical details. That is not really in my line. So those events were very much taken from life in a way that events of the first half of the novel were not really. And it was also my niece's personality is very much intact in that book. That was also not something I was going to make up.
Your niece was born with a genetic condition that very much shortened her life. And there's a real sense of the pain that you are witnessing in your wider family and an anger coming out that perhaps you don't allow your protagonist in the first half of the book.
That's true. I think that the first half of the book is angry in its way. But in the second half, this is allowed to rise to the surface. And it rises to the surface because all of these issues, what we think of as abstract issues, are instantiated in a person. You know, if you are concerned about disability rights, if you are concerned about reproductive rights, all of these things rise to the fore when they rise up in a person that you know and love, when it's instantiated in the form of your sister. And it's not just some abstract question of whether people should be allowed to terminate after viability. All of these things become very, very real to you. And then perhaps you are allowed to feel your anger as a visceral thing because suddenly there is a real body in the room and suddenly you feel yourself to be a real body as well.
It wouldn't be too glib then to say that this is a real life problem, whereas the things that were going on in the first half of the book on the portal were very much virtual.
They were virtual. That doesn't make them not real. It means that they're very far and it means that it is hard to know what exactly to do about them. You're feeling a great deal of impotence in the first half of the book. In the second half, there is also that impotence, but there's also the sense that she can do something, that she ought to be able to do something. She feels the hugeness of what she wants to do for the child and her sister pressing down on her. And sometimes that only means that what she can do is hold the child, hold her sister. You have to find the small, immediate things you can do in your life. And that's very difficult to do in a place like the portal.
And that is the crux of the title and presumably why you chose it.
Yeah. I mean, again, I keep saying it's a little bit of a joke as well, but it is. It's something that everyone was saying in the portal during the Trump administration, particularly like, look at this news story. No one is talking about this. But this is kind of how I felt at that time. This is something that I wanted to give to my protagonist as well, that real feeling.
Now, the book has been brought brilliantly to life as an audiobook by Kristin Sayer. I was wondering why you didn't choose to narrate it yourself.
I would happily have done so if they had asked. I really enjoy doing pre-study, but I think that the conditions of the pandemic made it so that that would have been an impossibility. And it's also nice to have someone professional do it. Reading an audiobook is incredibly physically difficult. You are in the studio day after day. It's like 5 hours I was doing on pre-study, and your tongue gets fat after a while, and you start being unable to read whatsoever. So it was sort of nice to take a rest. But you're right, there is a little bit of that, what if I had been able to do it, particularly the second half. I think that it would have been really beautiful to at least be able to try.
There are some visual jokes and quirks to the book that might not necessarily come through the narration, such as your protagonist's insistence on spelling sneezing with an A.
Yes, it is her addiction to spell the word sneezing with an A, yes. But you're quite right that there are things that probably only come across in text. And there's also some usage of emojis, which I would say is text reliant as well.
Many of which Kristin Sire goes to great pains to explain to those of us who wouldn't necessarily be able to see them.
This is quite interesting. I haven't actually listened to the audiobook yet. I've heard that she's done an excellent job, but it seemed like it would take me a little bit out of my body to listen to someone else reading my book, so I haven't actually done it. And I just did wonder for the first time, how do you represent, do you just say hand clap emoji, hand clap emoji, hand clap emoji? I'll have to listen to it for this reason.
Was she stimming? She feared very much that she was. Things that were always there. The sun. Her body, and the barest riffling at the roots of her hair. An almost music in the air, unarranged and primary and swirling like yarns laid out in their colors, waiting. The theme song of a childhood show where mannequins came to life at night in a department store. Anonymous History Channel footage of gray millions on the march, shark-snouted airplanes, silk deployments of missiles, mushroom clouds.
Kristin Sire narrating No One Is Talking About This, written by my guest, Patricia Lockwood.
And I know that your husband has a rare form of cataracts, so you must be pleased that your books have been turned into audiobooks so that people with print disabilities can access them.
Absolutely. And my niece, she was blind. And so it has become something that is very close to my heart. My husband developed subcapsular cataracts in 2012, and he did need to get lens implants for them. And this was a very big thing in our lives. You know, this is in America, and insurance wouldn't cover it because they said he was too young to require cataract surgery. So it's something that we had to raise money for on the internet. So you do become more aware. I'm probably too ignorant to call myself a disability activist, but you become more aware as things happen in your life, as you know more kinds of people, what you ought to be doing.
And while we have focused on some of the more negative aspects of the internet and social media, of course, it has given a voice to a lot of people who might otherwise find it difficult to get outside and stand on a soapbox.
Absolutely. And that's even true for me. I'm a person who can be sort of very restricted in my behavior. It's not always easy for me to switch gears, change modes, go outside into the beautiful afternoon. So the internet has been that sort of thing for me too. I would say that I am neuroatypical, and it has been a tremendous help for me.
Patricia Lockwood, thank you so much for taking us behind the scenes of No One Is Talking About This and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Red.
No One Is Talking About This is on its way to the RNIB Library, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation. You're listening to a special Booker Prize edition of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. And now, last but not least, Anuk Aradhprakasam is a Tamil Sri Lankan author, whose novel A Passage North tells the story of Krishan and his journey to attend his grandmother's carer's funeral at the other end of the country. Along the way, he confronts the lasting scars of the long Sri Lankan civil war and questions his own place in the world. Despite having no dialogue, the book is a lyrical meditation on time and loss. Read On producer Hannah caught up with Anuk when he was on a visit to Italy.
Anuk Aradhprakasam, first of all, welcome to Read On, and secondly, congratulations on being shortlisted for the Booker. You must be absolutely delighted.
I am excited. It comes with a lot of, I guess, mixed feelings because of the amount of publicity that is associated with this. I wasn't really aware of the prominence that it has in the UK. So a lot of it was surprise also at what it involves and the kind of like visibility that it involves. So there's a lot of feelings, a lot of processing, really.
So the book itself starts with your protagonist, Krishan, receiving a phone call to say that his grandmother's carer, Rani, has died while in the northeast of Sri Lanka. And at the same time, he gets an email from his ex-girlfriend, Anjum. Is it the congruence of those two events that make him decide to take the long journey to attend Rani's funeral?
Well, it really is mainly the call about Rani's death that sends him on the journey. The confluence of these two events, the email from his former lover, it coincides and it also kind of shapes his thinking as he travels north. But what really makes him take the journey is a kind of guilt, because Krishan, the main character, is Tamil and he's from the northeast, but he's grown up in the south of the country, in Colombo, where he's been relatively unscarred by the violence that took place at the end of the war. And so there's this kind of shame that he's been dealing with before the novel takes place. He was a PhD student in India while the war was taking place, while the final 2 years and all the violence and all the killing that involved was happening. And it leads him to leave his studies, to return to Sri Lanka, to work as a social worker, which is how he meets Rani. And so there's this constant sense of how fortunate he is. And I think that guilt plays an important role in making him go to the journey, but it's also a recurring theme throughout the text.
At the beginning of the book, Krishan seems almost detached from the horrors of the civil war. Do you think that those who lived in the South were protected in some way from what was going on?
Totally. Growing up in Colombo, there were, especially in the 90s, bombs every 2 or 3 months. We regularly hear about people dying in bombs and assassinations. And this is something that we were used to, kind of just part of the background of everyday life. Specifically as a Tamil growing up in the South, there were other dangers that one had to be wary of. Specifically kind of harassment and interrogations by the police, by soldiers who were stationed really on every other street in Colombo for all of my life growing up. But we didn't grow up in a war zone and we didn't grow up in the midst of the fighting. We were never displaced. Nobody in Colombo was displaced by the fighting in that sense. And specifically during the last 2 years of the war, when there was a lot of killing, government shelling killed between 40 and 150,000 Tamil civilians. A lot of this was unknown to people in Colombo. The government also prevented external observers, journalists, international organizations from entering the war zone during that last part of the conflict. And so not only were people in Colombo and in the South generally very much less affected by the violence, they were also, in a certain sense, totally unaware of, I guess, the massive loss of civilian life and the total destruction of Tamil society in that part of the country.
Do you feel that you also then had this sense of disconnect from it all?
Definitely. As these things were happening, people in Colombo, people in the diaspora, really didn't have a very concrete sense of the vastness and the systematicity of the violence. It was something that we only began to learn about in the months and years after the war was over, when footage that people took on their phones, on camera, started surfacing on the internet, when people began to write about these things, that really the true extent of death became known. And so it was kind of like hearing about something after it already happened. There's a very vivid sense of not just not being able to do anything, but of also a kind of guilt at going on as if life was normal while all this was happening. In the same way that, for example, in your own life, if one hears about the death of a loved one, maybe a couple of days late, and not just is one shocked and saddened by the death, but one is also slightly ashamed that for those 2 days that one should have been in mourning, one was living life as if nothing had happened. One was talking, laughing, eating, cooking, working. And there's a sense in which, in retrospect, that kind of normalcy seems perverse. And so that was a significant feeling I had when I began to find out about what had happened.
You decided to write the book in English rather than Tamil. Now, I know it's notoriously difficult to publish in Tamil, but with such a large diaspora, why did you make that choice?
Well, it wasn't really a choice in the sense that, well, I come from a Tamil-speaking family, but I'm bilingual, and my education was mainly in English. I went to university in English. I'm much more widely read, and English is the written language that I have most mastery over. And so in a way, it wasn't really, these were complex feelings. It was a complex subject. And in a way, it came naturally to write about these things in English. That's just obviously a mark of, you know, Sri Lanka was a colonized country. English has a kind of prestige and privilege that colonized languages like Tamil do not. And for most people who are capable of reading and writing in two languages, if they can speak and read in English and write in English, the uneven and imbalanced nature of the world is such that they generally choose English without thinking about it.
So moving on to the book now itself, the finality of the funeral is in quite stark contrast to the ongoing insecurity that Krishan has over his relationship with Anjum. Is that intentional?
That's an interesting question. You're right that the funeral has this finality. I mean, a body is being burned, it's being turned into ash and smoke. The smoke is dissipating across the sky. The ash is soon to be scattered. And so there is a certain kind of finality. But in a way, for me, the funeral is also a moment of uncertainty. And the book in general is a kind of book of uncertainty, specifically uncertainty of where to go from here, uncertainty about how one moves on. And in the funeral scene, Krishan is watching as the smoke billows up from the pyre and dissipates into the horizon. And it's this moment of where do we go from here? The concrete has become now abstract. It has thinned out into the atmosphere. And so for me, the whole book is a book built around, yes, certainty and finality about certain things, about events that took place, about the number of people who had died, about violence, but also a certain kind of lack of finality and uncertainty about how to respond to that.
The book covers a lot of fairly hefty themes. The scars, both physical and emotional, of the Civil War, the difference between idealism and pragmatism. But what struck me most was actually the description of Upama's aging, which was instantly familiar to me.
Mm.
Did you take this from your own relationship with one of your grandparents?
Yes, I did. Well, I only ever got to know one of my grandparents, my maternal grandmother, who I lived with all my life and who lives still at home with my parents. And we're very close. And I've watched her age over the years. And I've watched the kind of slow deterioration of her faculties and her mobility and her withdrawal slowly from the world. And so, I mean, in fact, the novel was meant initially to be just a novel about the relationship between a young man and his grandmother. It was supposed to be a novel that is dealing with what it means to participate in a world that you don't want to participate in, which is the case for Krishan, and then what it means to be pulled away from a world that you're used to participating, which is the case for Appamma. And only over the course of the writing did this material about the Civil War actually begin to seep into the text. But yeah, it was based on, I guess, my experiences with an aging loved one.
Unusually, the book has no dialogue to it, and your plot is minimal. Did you find it freeing to avoid those aspects of writing?
Yeah, I think so, because I really became a writer, I think, because I found that it was a way for me to think through certain kinds of questions of life. I was a philosophy student before I became a writer, and my first love in reading was philosophy, not fiction, not the novel, not poetry. And so when I moved to writing fiction, I moved because I felt philosophy was too abstract. It was thinking about questions of life in a way that was removed from the context of life, from the texture of life. And what I appreciated about fiction was that it was a place where I could ask these questions and think through these questions, but in the context of a real life, of a life that is being lived in the world as you and I know it. And at the same time, though, there are certain aspects of the novel or of fiction that I guess I didn't have much interest in. And one of those things was plot and narrative. And I love sharing stories and I love telling stories and hearing them. But it's never been really something that I have gone to literature for. And in a sense, it's also not something that I have strived to do in my own writing.
I think one of the nice things about it is that, in a sense, the plot is made up for by the references that you have to other cultural works in the novel, working almost as vignettes. You seem to blend them almost seamlessly into the text. How difficult was that?
I think that was really the biggest challenge of the text, because when you don't have a plot, I mean, there's a plot in the sense of we know that something is happening. Krishan receives a call He has to go to the Northeast and attend the funeral, and he wants in some way to find out whether the death of his grandmother's caretaker, Rani, was accidental, as it seems, or whether it was potentially a suicide, because Rani was a traumatized woman. She lost both of her sons in the last months of the war. But one realizes very quickly that the novel is not about actually discovering whether Rani's death was suicide, that it really is about this kind of movement between perception and memory and conjecture and thought. And I think when you don't have a plot to dictate the ordering of the text, when you don't have a plot to say B comes after A and before C, there's this question of how do we organize all of these materials? How do we organize the things that Krishan sees? How do we organize the things that he thinks about and the things that he remembers? And how do we bring all of these disparate materials together in a way that what we have is one text rather than a series of discrete separate parts? And so I spent a lot of time, really most of the time I spent writing this novel was spent trying to bring this material together, like understanding how to transition from one kind to another.
Now, one of the things that comes up in the book is sight, gaze. There's a wonderful section where Anjum is talking about how men in Delhi look at women. Did you think the visual aspect of the book was important to you?
Yes, I think it was. And I mean, it was very much how I conceptualized this novel. My first novel actually isn't a very visual novel at all. It actually deals with sound in a much more serious way. And that's because my first novel was set in a war zone where one hears things always before one sees them, because that's how, for example, one experiences a bomb or one experiences gunfire. One doesn't know where these things are coming from. Whereas this book is kind of dealing with the war and with the violence of war at a distance, at a remove, which is how Krishan, who is not from the war zone, experiences the war. And so there's this corresponding emphasis on the visual in the text. And so, yeah, the book is full of, I guess, reflections on gaze and on seeing. And it's interesting, but this summer I was thinking about how much material there is on vision in this text and how actually little I know about the experience of people who are not sighted or people who are partially sighted. And I read this book called Sight Unseen. It's a really wonderful book by an academic called Georgina Klieg. And she talks a lot about the ways in which sight and vision are used as metaphors in films, in literary texts. And I have to admit, I realized that a lot of assumptions, a lot of sighted assumptions that a lot of writers and filmmakers have relied on unthinkingly were also made by me in the course of this text. I felt a little bit embarrassed and a little bit ashamed that there was this entire theme in this text that I hadn't really bothered, out of laziness, I suppose, to think about more thoroughly.
On the plus side, the audiobook is brought brilliantly and very lyrically to life by Neil Shah. Did you have anything to do with choosing him as a narrator?
Well, I was offered a few individuals as candidates for the audiobook, and I really like Neil Shah's pacing, the kind of calmness with which he seemed to read a lot of the texts that he had done. Neil Shah is in Tamil, and he, for example, doesn't know, or one assumes that he's unaware of a lot of Tamil pronunciation. Mm-hmm. And so I made a little audio note of pronunciations and sent it to him. Yeah, I think the final product is very nice, and it's a very sensitive reading of the text.
He'd come home not long before from the office of the NGO at which he worked, had taken off his shoes and come upstairs to find, as usual, his grandmother standing outside his room, waiting impatiently to share all the thoughts she'd saved up over the course of the day. His grandmother knew he left work between 5 and 5:30 on most days, that if he came straight home, depending on whether he took a three-wheeler, bus, or walked, he could be expected at home between 5:15 and 6:15. His timely arrival was an axiom in the organization of her day, and she held him to it with such severity that she would, if there was ever any deviation from the norm, be appeased only by a detailed explanation.
Neil Shah, narrating A Passage North, written by my guest, Anuk Aridprakasam.
Have you made that journey that Krishan makes yourself?
Yes, I have. I've made it many times. I've spent a lot of time in the Northeast. My parents are from a village in the northern tip of Sri Lanka, and because of the war, I had never visited the Northeast, even though that's where I'm from, that's my homeland, until I was, I think, 20 or 21. So it was a place I had imagined for many years, but never had actually traveled to. And when the war was over, I went with my mother, father, and sister, and we visited the place that we're from for the first time. And so this movement for South to North, I think for a lot of Tamils who have been cut off from their ancestral places, was very significant, the ability to actually move from South to North.
You have already written twice about the Civil War. I believe you're writing your third novel at the moment. Does that also include aspects of the Civil War in it as part of Tamil identity?
It does. My third novel is set in the diaspora. It's about two young Tamil friends from Toronto and the relationship between one of them and her mother. And in that sense, it is related to the war because of the Tamil population in Sri Lanka of about 3.5 million people, almost half of that population, 1.5 million, has fled the country. Most of them as refugees who've settled down in Toronto, many of them in London and Paris. A number of them still live in refugee camps in South India. And so diaspora, the idea of being cut off from your homeland and the center of your culture, is a very significant and central part of the Tamil experience, I would say. And so in that sense, it is related to the war. But I've been trying, to be honest, to move as far away from the violence as possible.
Well, I very much look forward to reading your third novel when it comes out. Anouk, thank you so much for joining us on Read On.
Thank you so much, Hannah.
Like all the books on this and previous Booker Prize shortlists, A Passage North is available from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generosity of the Booker Foundation.
Robert here with some news about the Boswell Book Festival. You may remember that we covered the virtual event back in June of this year. Well, to celebrate Boswell's birthday weekend, the whole festival will be rerun from the 29th to the 31st of October. That's all the events from June plus two brand new talks. And, of course, it's free to virtually attend. Just head to boswellbookfestival.co.uk or find them on Twitter at BozzyFest, BozzyFest. And if you search for Boswell Book Festival RNIB, you can find many of the past shows that Red and myself have recorded there. But head to boswellbookfestival.co.uk to rerun this year's entire festival. Back to you, Red.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to Read On!